Sunday, 12th April, 1987. We are now at Chapter 6. Last time we mentioned how in the Upanishads it is stated that when in Maitreya speaks, Maitreya asks the question, he is answered by Mahadeva, which is another name of the great god Shiva. And similarly, there are many instances throughout the scriptures of the world of the conversation between man and God. The Archangel Gabriel, and so on. Now, various are the approaches to the supreme communion in silent aloneness. In the state of the supreme communion, there is complete and utter silence. The brain has definitely stopped talking, because it is only when the brain stops talking that the deepest elements of consciousness in us are awake. And that is the holistic consciousness, which is awake and receptive to transcendence itself. You know how in the Kundalini Yoga it is said that at the Sahasrara Chakra, here at the brain, is the point of contact with Shiva. Shiva contacts the person at the Sahasrara Chakra. But that Sahasrara Chakra is reached only when there is complete silence. When the heart grows still with the touch of beauty, when self so surrenders that passion meets love as the river meets the sea, when the mind is so free of all images that truth shines shadowless, or when the votive act flows into the heart of infinite grace, there are no gates to bar the way to the Supreme. When the heart grows still with the touch of beauty. This beauty refers to the beauty of transcendence itself, which is utterly indescribable, unimaginable. It is not a sensation. It is not a judgment from the person at all. That beauty is there forever and ever. And when our heart is silent, it is still and quiet, not in any state of turmoil, then one senses, I use the word sense because it is the only convenient English word, one senses, or if you like, one touches that beauty. That is to say, actually, that beauty enters into one's being. And that beauty is the beauty of all beauty, which has made the beauty of all existence, of the whole universe. And it is a beauty for which there are no criteria, there are no ways to measure it, no standards of judgment or anything. It is beauty. And you sense it, and when you emerge out of the state of silence, you know it as beauty. You won't know it as any other aspect of the manifestation of transcendence, such as truth or goodness or something like that. When self so surrenders that passion meets love, as the river meets the sea, this passion has nothing whatsoever to do with passion as we usually use the word, in the sense of being in a temper, is got into a passion, or a sexual passion, or whatever other passion that there is. This has the deeper meaning, which is derived from the root of the word passion. The Latin passio means I suffer. I suffer not with the suffering that is the result of some sensational pain or whatever, or illness which the body is suffering. It is not that passion. It is this profound compassion within oneself, which is really transcendent love, which suffers with the suffering of mankind, of all mankind. In fact, not only of all mankind, but of all creation. And then, perhaps one way to understand this deeply is like this. All creation, all existence, is a standing out of the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality, transcendence itself. When that primordial creative energy is active, it puts forth a universe. But that universe is outside itself. And yet, at the same time, it is that very transcendent creative energy which becomes the universe. Don't cudgel your brain to try and understand it. You will glimpse it somehow or other if and when you are truly quiet. I can't suggest any special meditative ways or... or anything like that to help you to arrive at it. You can't arrive at these things. You can't arrive at transcendence or attain it or achieve it or something. It happens. And its happening means really that it is transcendence all the time which is the real doer. I do nothing. It is transcendence which does the whole thing. Only I can become, I as the individual, can be aware of that fact if I am sufficiently sensible, sensitive, and pure in mind. Then I can become aware of that fact, that it is transcendence working in this way. So, when passion meets love, as the river meets the sea, then again, when the mind is so free of all images that truth shines shadowless, all our beliefs, our ideas, our conceptions, our convictions, and so on, they all are images which becloud the pure mind which can function through us if we let it. And it can function only as and when the psyche is utterly purified. You can't purify it by looking at it like a doctor looks at some diseased condition and says, oh, now we shall operate on this and get it out. You can't do it that way. You just look. And if you look and look and look without judgment, without striving to clear out something or attain something through dealing with it, then it will happen. This is the way of eternal life. And when the psyche is free of all its images then truth shines shadowless. Because the deepest aspect of consciousness in your own being is now well awake. And it is awake to that truth which is beyond all concepts and therefore also outside the sphere of all words. When the votive act flows into the heart of infinite grace, the votive act is that devoted action which flows spontaneously out of you as expressing the supreme that you are capable of. It is not an act which has a purpose behind it. It is not an act which is driven by desire or by some planned out conception. It is just that spontaneous act of the living being, the unknown living being which is within oneself, which is the votive act. And when that flows into the heart of infinite grace, which is all around us all the time, only we are insensitive to it, there are no gates then to bar the way to the Supreme. Before the complete emergence, emergence into the silence, there is a state of discriminative consciousness characteristic of the Holy One's approach on each separate occasion. Now this is where the systems of meditation come in. There comes a stage in that meditative process when you are beginning to transcend the totality of the manifested universe. And before actually entering into that state, there is discriminative consciousness, vijnana as the Pali word goes, still functioning. And according to that particular vijnana will be the gate of entry, so to say, into the infinite. First the infinity of akasha and then of vijnana and so on, you see. So there is a state of discriminative consciousness characteristic of the Holy One's approach to each separate occasion. The Holy One can choose any particular mode of entry. And after having chosen it, as he enters into the supreme silence, the infinity, the eternity of reality, then that discriminative consciousness is completely quiet. It no longer functions. The consciousness which functions is the transcendent consciousness. The silence itself is devoid of both discriminative consciousness and unconsciousness. Now here there is an important point involved. So many scholars, practically all of them, and even some of the greatest of the psychologists now living in the world, have fallen into the trap of calling this state a state of trance. It is not a trance. It is not a self-hypnotic or a state of being self-mesmerized. It's nothing of the sort. It's a completely awakened state. An awakening which I can't put into words or concepts. You have to experience it, even a flash of that experience. will make you aware that that is the case. So trance is a hopeless word here. You are neither discriminatively conscious nor are you unconscious, but you are conscious in that supreme sense where there is the complete silence enveloping you and radiating from you. And in this state, awareness or consciousness and being exist, your existence as such, are identical. Then comes the emergence out of that state. As the emergence out of the silence proceeds, that awareness being suffers limitation into form, a form distinguished by attributes traditionally associated with one or other of the divine names, which are the springs of power and benediction in the scriptures of the world. You know, for instance, in the Zarathustrian teachings, there are 101 names given to Ahura Mazda, God. And each of those names is a word of power, and it stands for that mode of functioning of the transcendent creative energy which you yourself could utilize by invoking that power. I wonder how many people who have talked about invoking and evoking the divine names really understand what they are talking about. They have said the words, but do they really, have they really penetrated into its inner meaning? It is a wielding of a tremendous energy, a tremendous power. Which acts like a purifying agent for the whole psychical atmosphere of your environment, possibly of the world. Now, this mode of consciousness is the fount of inspired teachings which the Holy One presents in the shape of the divine dialogue. You know, I mean, you read the Old Testament, you will find plenty of examples of the divine dialogue. And the angel of the Lord appeared and spoke, and this, that, and the other. You see. Every sentence of this prophetic speech is the milk of deep prayer and the bread of contemplation for his disciple. Now do realize that this contemplation does not mean what we ordinarily mean by meditation, which is musing, which is a ritual process. You talk according to a set pattern, but in talking according to a set pattern, the brain only is active, but there is no special power implied in that process. The contemplation in the profound sense begins with the first stages of silence. People don't realize that. For another example, you know how in the Buddhist Brahma-Viharic meditations you send out metta, karuna, mudita, and upekha to the teacher, to yourself, to those in difficulty, to those in trouble, to yourself, to your enemy, and so on and so on, you see. Now, what is it that you send out? Supposing the brain says, may all beings in the East have peace. Look at the East. Middle East, Southeast, any place. Is there peace and quiet? And to what extent have you wielded a power? None. Really. It may be helpful for you yourself. But apart from that, there's very little effect anywhere else, if there is any at all. But as and when one passes what is commonly called the fourth jhana, and remember that in that there is the going down of all sensory impressions. You see? That means that the mode of consciousness which deals with this manifested world has come to rest. Then you enter into the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana. And there, in those states, you can wield this transcendent power, this transcendent energy. Then you, if you send out metta, that metta is not metta as defined in the dictionary or as understood by oneself, by one's own brain. It is something quite different. It is a true healing power. Consider the miracles of Jesus, or the miracles which are attributed to so many of the great spiritual, the true spiritual teachers. And if you can be quiet, the quieter you are, the more you will understand. And then you will realize what is meant by that spiritual healing in the true sense. Otherwise, the laying of hands and all that sort of thing, it sometimes has an effect, yes, because the person on whom the hands are laid and the person who is laying the hands believe strongly that this can happen, this will help me. Therefore, there is help. But it has emerged out of your own psychophysical constitution. Do remember that. Don't think that this is something godlike or transcendent. It is a phenomenon. And the whole of the phenomenal world is the world of death. The named divinities are products of man's mind, temporal and unreal, labels, so to say, of the immortal real. I use the phrase the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy to represent in words that which is origin, absolute origin, which is indescribable. There are no words for it, there are no thoughts for it. But we have to use words if we are to convey anything at all to each other at our level in the ordinary way, you see. So, we must realize that these divinities which are named are just products of man's mind. They are temporal and unreal. But they are like, if you like, shadows, or if you like, photographs of the real. But the photograph isn't the real. That painting of me is not me. I'm here. That photograph's there, and always will be there, and not here, sitting and talking. Another word in connection with the previous sentence, about prophetic speech, and deep prayer, and so on, and contemplation. Remember that very wise verse. A wise old bird sat upon an oak. The less he spoke, the more he heard, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we be like that wise old bird? Well, why? Because we are too full of our petty little self and all our petty little problems. That's why we can't keep quiet. The less he spoke. The brain is talking all the time. It won't keep quiet. Observe that talking. And if you observe that talking in a friendly way, it's you yourself. Don't treat yourself as your enemy or somebody to control forcibly. It's a profound error. Punishment never made a person virtuous. Just look quietly, and that talking brain will feel, oh, I think I better stop now, you know, and have a rest. And that way the state of silence can emerge more easily. Now, merely to read the letter of the scriptures easily misleads the reader into regarding the named divinities as independent, personal beings, other than him who is in communion. If he who reads has known a loosening of the bonds, better still, the dissolution of the limitations imposed by separative self-consciousness, he will be free of the confusion-making conflicts between the I and the Thou. Then he will not mistake the inward divinity as a transcendent being wholly other than the self-conscious I. Then too he will become aware, provided his thought processes do not interfere, of the living meaning hidden in the words of Scripture. In Exodus chapter 3 verse 14, Yahweh Elohim speaks out of the burning bush to Moses when Moses asks him, "What shall I say to the Israelites when they ask me, who has sent you to deliver us?" And Yahweh Elohim says, "Say, Ahiye Asher Ahiye. I am that I am." You see, the Hebrew scriptures and the Kabbalah regarded the Supreme in terms of the I am, the ultimate I am. The Sanskrit equivalent is Atma, the Upanishadic equivalent, Atma. I put it out in early Indian religious thought that if Brahman were to speak the Sanskrit language and say, "I am," then that I am is the meaning of Atma. It's like that. So, I am that I am. Because here, Moses is in complete communion with Yahweh Elohim. Not as an other something, but as the absolute ultimate reality, the truth. Again, the Upanishadic sages said, "Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman." Aham, I, Brahma, Asmi is am, I am, the first person singular. I am Brahman. Now, of course, scholars, particularly in the last century, not in this century, they have written criticizing this, saying, "What extraordinary self-conceit these people possessed. I am Brahman. I am God." But that is the fact. You are God. You are Brahman. But you and I are not fully awake to that. That is all. We may believe it for this or that or the other reason, but mere belief is not the actuality. The belief is the ghost of the actuality. The Buddha said, the Tathagata is a name tantamount to truth, tantamount to Brahman. And again, he goes on, the Tathagata is the Dhamma become, the Brahma become. What is that apart from saying, I am the truth, I am the Supreme, the divinity itself? You know, in all the great religions you find the great mystics saying precisely this, without any hesitation. I think Saint Benedict talked of the deification of the individual, and possibly Eckhart did, but I'm not quite certain of that. You see? The deification of the individual. How the Catholic Church let that pass, I don't know. Thank goodness they must have been fast asleep when the truth was spoken like that. And therefore, the words of Jesus, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Al-Halaj, that great Sufi mystic, who was most cruelly crucified by the Muslims for saying, An al-Haq, I am the truth, or I am God. He wouldn't have said, I am Allah. He said, An al-Haq, I am the truth. And it is also interpreted, I think Professor Arbery puts it like this, I am the sign of God. And in the Tejubindu Upanishad we have, I am the I. Shiva himself says this to his disciple Kumara the Kartikeya. I am the I that has given up I. What does that mean? That has become free of this separative self-consciousness. I am not this, that or the other. Prior to saying, he ends up the discourse that way. So prior to that he says, I am this, that and the other. You know how they go on tediously mentioning everything that they know in the world or which they can name and so on. I am this, I am the other. Partly like Sri Krishna, but Sri Krishna, the writer of the Gita, put it in a rather more aesthetic form, and in a shorter, more succinctly too. I am the All, the Absolute. The Supreme Communion is not the communing of an I, one I, with a separate Thou. In the Supreme Communion, there is a vanishing of the opaque barrier of separative self-consciousness. Phenomenally, the separate psychophysical organism which bears the speaker's or teacher's name is there, a tangible living man visible to all. But with the vanishing of self-consciousness, he who erstwhile was conscious as I am myself and not you is no longer conscious in those terms, nor in the terms thou and I are one. I don't know exactly what Jesus may have said when he said, my Father and I are one. I don't know the Aramaic. I don't know Hebrew either, you see. but the translation, my Father and I are one, still emphasizes a duality, thou and I. But there is not that duality. You know, it's a very interesting fact that when the Big Bang took place, that Big Bang took place out of the totality of the universe crammed into the size of a pinhead practically, a thousandth of a centimeter in diameter. This is what the mathematics of quantum mechanics tells us. When that took place, there emerged at once, as a result of the thunder of the gods, as I call it, an infinite number of particles and antiparticles. These are in the subatomic condition. Electrons, neutrons, and protons are also subatomic, you see. But these are the sub-subatomic particles. Now, they possessed electric charge, positive and negative. The positively charged particles, trying to merge with the negatively charged antiparticles, just underwent destruction, annihilation. They were annihilated as themselves, but in that annihilation, they gave rise to an infinite number of other elementary particles, as elementary as they themselves were, and as massive, if you like. Now you've got a marvelous Irish stew there. You see? So, this carnage between the positive and the negative started off the universe. That carnage got rid of particles and antiparticles, but there was a certain leftover. And that leftover became what we now see as the total cosmos, all the galaxies and so on. It's a wonderful, wonderful story, assuming that it is correct. And I don't doubt that it is at least nearer correctness than most other stories. Certainly the ordinary mythological tales you can just leave for the children to amuse themselves with. But there it is. This duality of the particles and antiparticles started off with the very beginning of the manifested universe. All manifestation, all existence is subject to this conflict because of duality. The positive, the negative, the male, the female, the good, the bad, and so on and so on. Our task is to see into it, to understand it. And in that understanding, which needs also profound love underlying it, there will come harmony. There will begin to come harmony. Another million years perhaps, we'll talk about it then. So, in the Supreme Communion, the person is in the state of I Am, the one and only I Am, which is the one total absolute reality. He does not know in the ordinary sense of a perceiving subject, knowing an observed object, that he is in the I Am state, when the I Am state shines unobstructedly through him. Thus, the Supreme Communion is in actual fact the disappearance of all that dismembers the primordial unity. There is no separative consciousness of discrete particulars to sunder the unity of the I Am. Here the word I is not a personal pronoun, nor does it represent a blown-up self-become-super-self by union with a God born of man's imagination. In this communion, where selfness is completely absent, the word I may be spoken of as transpersonal. I am the I which has given up I, freed itself from separative self-consciousness.